Welcome to the Sunday Scotch Society. I am the intrepid, how does one say this? I would say pilot, except I'm also the one that generally wanders off track. So I wouldn't, that's not necessarily a good pilot. K. Quincy Parker is my name, my co-host, and I guess true pilot is one Matthew Kelly.
I shall introduce myself as the Nefarious Navigator.
The Nefarious Navigator, yes. And today's scotch is something I am incredibly excited about because I have never had it. It is the Grand Old Parr, 18-year-old Kentucky, blended Scotch whiskey. And as a rule, we all know that I'm not a blended Scotch fan per se, but this stuff looks incredible. Before we do all the things that we usually do here on the Sunday Scotch Society, I would like to introduce our guest, our beloved, celebrated, and highly respected and admired guest, someone that I believe one Mr. Kelly finds inspiring. I'm going to use that word. I don't know if it's true, but that's what he said to me. So we'll find out. And we'll find out why. Her name is Tara Woodside. And yes, that is a round of applause that you are hearing from cyberspace and from all the people who know you.
Yay!
Tara, welcome to the Sunday Scotch Society.
Thank you for having me. And I would actually be happy to be the flight attendant for this trip. Okay, never mind. He was pilot, co-pilot. I'm like, can I be a flight attendant? At least, come on. But anyway.
Well, I mean,
our intention is to have you fly first class.
Oh, absolutely.
However,
I can do that.
Should you volunteer, we will not be against it.
Wonderful.
I have a sort of a list of questions for you, Tara Woodside, but I am also cognizant of a sort of history in this arena of seizing the lead.
Okay.
And this time I wish to seize the second place and cede the ground to my brother Matthew to take charge of this this particular conversation. But before Matthew does that, I want to point out that at some point I'm going to ask you about your tattoo.
Okay. Which one? Oh, the one we can see. Okay, good. All right, gotcha. But then, all right, let's go.
I was gonna say the one I could see.
This is adult programming, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I just wasn't sure that, you know. Right. So, Matthew, if you would, perhaps we should, you know.
Let us do the do.
Yeah. So, the old Parr, the grand old Parr, 18-year-old blended Scotch whiskey, smells divine. The nose is a little citrusy, it's a little sharp. It has there's obviously alcohol there, you know. But there's also a hint in the back of some fruit, maybe some candy. So I'm really looking forward to tasting it. I'm really, really looking forward to it. You have the contemplative look on your face as you from time to time do in these situations. What is your contemplation telling you?
I am simply contemplating the fact that I continue to be a neophyte in whiskey, and The prominent notes are that sort of soft candy toffee, and I'm just searching for the more subtle. I do get a slight hint of the citrus that you talk about, but nothing that I could call out as an individual note. So I am more or less just contemplating how much of a noob I am.
What? Before you continue, sir, I cannot wait to begin recording these podcasts on video so that people can see the mannerisms. Because Matthew's body language just now is hilarious. I loved it. Tara, did you have an opportunity to take a whiff and form an opinion on the nose of the Grand Ole Parr?
Yeah, I did. I sniffed it and it smelled like alcohol. I'm not going to pretend like I even know the difference of any notes of anything in this. I just know vodka, and this isn't it. So it's
okay.
Great. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it smells like a stuff.
The note I'm getting from you is one of pure frankness and honesty, and it is one of the things that I absolutely adore about you.
Yeah.
And by you, ladies and gentlemen, I suspect he's talking about Tara and not me.
That is a given.
Is he suggesting that I'm not straightforward? Or?
You're just not an aspiring beam of light like me, so there we go. Sorry, go ahead.
Shall we sip?
We've taken the first sip. You've had a moment to let it sit on your palate. What are your thoughts?
It's quite alcohol forward. The finish is kind of odd. It's cloyy without any specific note for me. It's not bad, but it's not so voluptuous as some of the other spirits that you've brought on. I would love this in eggnog, I think. Not to cover it up, but I think that would just add to what it's bringing. Here's some noob thing that I've been noticing, right, is the particular tingle that I'm getting from whiskeys seems to be quite different from any other alcohol. So I just, on the finish, I have on the lips and forward tongue just this prickly, pleasant tingle. I don't know if that's something that other people experience. It could just be post-COVID.
It could be that too.
Issue for me. I don't know.
Well, I don't think it is though. Most of the good scotches / bourbons / whiskeys that we've had on the show and at Whiskey Wednesdays are, you know, at least 90 proof. Some of them have been higher than that. So you're talking about really, really alcoholic beverages that are traditionally a little more, they're a little stronger than the other alcohols, right? Except really the only one that's consistently that strong is rum. Right, the vodkas are about 80 proof, and the gins are about whatever, you know. So, the scotches tend to be a little stronger, and I think that's what you're tasting.
I do note now that this is quite a long finish, and I'm getting some nutty, almost between an almond and peanut, flavor there. No, not in a bad way. In a properly roasted over an a palate fueled flame by a Rasta who know what he's doing. Roasted peanut.
I get you. I get the guy who's on is that Blue Hill Road and Meadow Street? Yeah, he usually standing right there roasting. Yeah, I like that guy. I added a drop of water to it to help it open up a little bit, and it did. It pushed a little bit of the alcohol aside, but it I don't know if you've been, I think the closest flavor that I can think of is fruitcake.
Okay, well, wonderful. I'm not looking forward to drinking this.
And I'm not saying that it tastes... I'm not saying you taste like you drink fruitcake. I'm saying that when you drink it and the finish is finishing, the lingering flavors have...
I could see that, but in the most pleasant experience that I've had of a fruitcake, because that is a thing... I don't necessarily want to call it baked good because is it? What is that?
Yeah.
Why is that?
Because it's
not a fan.
No, good
I'm in solidarity.
Good fruitcake is both of you are wrong. Good fruitcake takes
it's okay to
5 hours to make.
It's been 5 centuries, but there's only been one. I think it's already been passed around.
This is a conspiracy that I can get behind.
No, I disagree.
There's only been one fruitcake.
I have stirred fruitcake for decades, and they soak.
And it's still not finished.
They soak year long. They soak in Meyer's dark rum, and. Unless you have had Diana Knowles' fruitcake soaked in Meyer's dark rum,
listen,
you do not know what you are missing. That's all I will say.
As a person who thinks more in terms of probabilities, I am open to some possibility in the future of my mind being changed. However, the probability that I assign to this is extremely low.
You know what I mean? Like, I actually want to believe what he's saying right now. I'm like, you know what? I want it to change. I want to be pleasantly surprised. But I also don't want to, like, destroy that picture you have in your mind of that food cake by Diana Knowles. Is that who it is? Right? And then, like, eat it and, like, spit it out in front of you. Did I just ruin it for you? I'm sorry.
Yes. All
like,
right.
No,
I don't
want to
do that.
I want you to understand, I don't care what your reaction is.
I love it. Thank you.
Right?
Yeah.
You could vomit, and I would not care.
Wow.
Because the Diana Knowles fruitcake is number one, it's a once a year thing, and number two, it's
a fruitcake. Listen, it's a fruitcake, not for Diana. Richard's a lovely baker.
Yeah. But once you have the Diana Knowles fruitcake once a year, that's good enough for the next 12 months.
Oh, it's a beautiful thing. I thought you were going to say years.
20 years.
But, so, dear listener. There's a high probability, I understand, that you think that Tara and I are wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Add us on socials and also produce the proof. The holidays are coming up. If indeed this thing exists, prove it to us.
Listen, I'll try it.
We're open to the possibility.
I'm absolutely open to that.
We just think that you're going
to
fit.
I want to be converted. I really do, honestly. I would love to change my opinion on that. I would love to.
All right, fine. Moving on.
With that, yes. Was there anything else you wanted to hit, Quincy, before I begin this conversation with Tara proper?
No, the Grand Old Par, aged 18 years, is a decent blended Scotch whiskey. I think that... I will be trying to figure out what to pair it with while we chat. Immediately, desserts come to mind. Flans, a parfait, something that is both sweet and savory that could stand up to the alcohol but also bring out some of the fruit flavors in the whiskey. So, yeah. I'm good. Onward. Let us forge ahead.
Yeah, so I think we ended before I asked Quincy that by saying that you're open to the possibility you want to be converted. And I would like to begin the conversation by asking you, what are some of the positions that you hold lightly, if strongly? That you don't mind being converted on.
Wait.
Yeah, I'm like, what?
I'm confused about this question.
I am
sorry.
So confused right now.
Yeah, so the same way.
If you were a child.
Okay,
honestly,
okay.
I don't.
All right, you know,
explain it to me like I'm a 2-year-old, as Denzel
awesome.
Would say.
All right, I think 2-year-olds, that's when I walk out of the room. So for instance, the same way that we'd be okay changing our minds if the correct example of Fouquet came along, what's something that you have in the past believed and changed your mind on, or currently believe but you're open to changing your mind about?
That's a good question. Wow. No, but I haven't been converted yet. Sorry, never mind. Never mind.
No, but you're open to being converted.
Oh, electric cars. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, that. Yeah, a lot of people are trying to convert me now. Like, listen, electric cars is the way of the future. I'm like, I believe you. And I am 100% behind that.
Mm-hmm.
Only thing is, I'm like, I live in the Bahamas. So it doesn't seem to work out. Not just yet. I'll stick with my little... quote-unquote gas guzzler, I guess, until then.
I'm going to back you up for several reasons here. Like, I'm one of these people. I'm what some people might consider an environmentalist. However, I'm a realist about the situation. And if for instance, we changed our fleet out at the rate of whatever we change our cars, 2, 3, 5 years, mostly we'd be getting second hands. With electric cars, if that's the early set of cars, the batteries are not going to be as good as they need to be for us to do that. What about the grid here? We could hardly keep up with what
Thank
we
you.
Have. Like, how are you going to get support?
That's the thing I'm worried about.
You can have a Bush mechanic working on your electric car. Like, there's issues here. And I support in principle the move to electric cars,
yeah.
Right? But for the Bahamas... And I got to understand these people driving Teslas here. How rich are you? Because when this thing goes down, you got to put this thing on the boat to take it to the States to get looked at and then bring it back.
That's exactly it. And to be honest with you, the first thing that comes to mind when I do see a Tesla on the road, I'm like, that's clearly a different tax bracket. I'm not there yet.
Yeah.
And I'm like, we're good on them. Good on that.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, and if you're not in the tax bracket, stop lying to yourself. You're going to be waiting a while because the practicality of that is kind of...
So, I have a slightly different take, especially on the Tesla. Most people that I see driving Teslas, I believe, are driving the Tesla in an aspirational sense.
Oh, okay.
There is very little chance that they actually can afford to drive a Tesla. But they've bought one secondhand out of California or wherever they got it from. They drive it on the street and pray every day that nothing happens. And should something happen, I believe that if we were to take a drone and fly it around the island, we would find a number of Teslas parked in the back of people's yards waiting for the day when they make the $50,000 they need to repair and get their Tesla back on the road.
Not only that, they'd be sitting next to a Paso because they had to replace it with that. I'm sorry. It's easy.
That's what I
do.
That is what I believe.
I can see that vision.
Quick straw poll, Paso or note?
Oh my gosh.
To me, it's the same thing, honestly. I don't see the difference.
I refer to them both as demon cars.
Aren't they both Toyotas?
No,
one's a Nissan.
Yes.
And the reason I refer to them as demon cars is because demons drive them. And when you I've experienced this myself, when you sit behind the wheel of a Paso or a Note, you become a demon. Because you drive the car in a way that makes no sense for the car you're driving. You drive the car as if it's a tank, when what it really is a piece of tin foil with wheels.
I actually
agree with you. But it wasn't with the I'm going to say it right now, only because about 3-4 years back, I had to end up going to an event. It was some award show, and my vehicles went down. I mean, all of them. And I had to rent a vehicle, and the only one they had available was a March. Okay, and when I
the March is the worst.
I know. I'm about to tell you that right now. So I'm like, ugh, a March. And I was like, well, is AC cold? And that's the thing I was worried about, because I'm like, And he was like, yeah, absolutely. Sat down, like, oh, this is such a stupid, tiny little car. And when I sat down, I kid you not, the first 10 minutes of that car ride, I think I had morphed into something completely different. And that little thing was fast, okay? And I thought I could take on the world in this little thing. And that's exactly how I drove it. And I'm like, I see why people lose their mind. Oh, my goodness, like a possession. The car possesses you.
So I hear you guys.
I'll never buy one. I'm just telling you. But I was like, that thing was swift, okay? That AC was chilly. I loved it. I could throw it anywhere. It didn't matter. And it didn't matter to me if people hit me in it. I was like, it doesn't matter. But I'm like, okay.
But that's the problem. That's the problem.
I know. That's,
if people
like,
hit you in it, you're going to die.
I realized that. I realized that.
That's the problem.
But my mind was telling me, you're invincible. Okay.
Exactly.
Right.
But the car whispers to you. It was like, what was that car movie back in the day?
Christine.
Christine. That's what it was. It was Christine. She's like, you're fine. I'm like, okay, I got it.
Okay. But I'm going to counter with little ladies in huge SUVs also think that they're invincible, right? And I put it to you that perhaps, just consider that maybe it's not necessarily the car, but the car is an enabler of something that is deep within you guys' souls. It's like money does not corrupt, but reveals. Perhaps marches and notes and passos. And for little ladies, huge SUVs reveal something inside of you.
Matthew, I don't appreciate you calling me out like that. because there is some truth to what you're saying, for real. It's no secret. I like fast cars. So it is what it is. And I'm like, okay, you're right. Okay, I like speed. I didn't expect that to be that fast. I mean, I didn't expect the march to be that fast. Mine just like that. It's like 2 pounds, and you're like, ooh, you just fly off and you're ready, great.
Fast and Furious!
You know, so.
I don't know if anybody remembers the Honda CRX when they first came out.
Yeah, I do.
The number of guys who flipped those cars and got into accidents because they just, they were so fast, and you couldn't turn any corners at speed. Because once the air got underneath the car, it just flipped it over.
There was an epidemic, actually. It was like in the early 2000s when it came to the Japanese import vehicles. I was a part of that crew. Mind you, I didn't wreck any of my vehicles. But it was the Evolution, the Evos. That's a Mitsubishi Evolution. Yeah, anyway, long story short, they're the fast ones that are like raced on the tracks. There was this guy who used to sell cars on Soldier Road. I don't want to call the names, but anyway, there's a car lot. He only sold those. And I'm telling you, all those were written off within the first 2 years of him selling. Everybody sold them to. People just drove like maniacs and just crashed them because it just took air so easily.
High turnover. Yeah. Sounds like a great business.
He did exception. I might as well tell you right now.
Okay.
So
is there a napkin?
So you've revealed that
thank you.
You're actually a bit of a fan of cars.
Yeah.
Is it just the speed, or is there something else?
I'll be honest with you. I'm gonna speak only to myself, which is about me, which is this. I like what I like. It doesn't necessarily have to be a fast car, because I do like luxury vehicles as well. But personally, fast cars, I do like them a lot. But I'm a big fan of Subarus, Audis, and things like that. Mm-hmm. And that's just my thing. BMW. So most of the German engineering is something I'm interested in.
Okay.
Outside of that.
So, when I introduced you to Quincy this morning, he actually asked a very interesting question.
Which one?
About the accent.
Yeah.
For Pete's Peppers. Okay.
Pete's
Peppers. She said for Pete's Peppers.
Indeed, and I think that the accent, the answer to this question about where the accent comes from, may reveal a bit about that.
About Pete's Peppers?
Nobody where it came from.
Annie Hoos Obese.
Annie Hoos Obese, yeah. I love it. That's my thing.
I know.
I make things up so I won't have to swear. You know,
That's one of the gems that I got from you. Annie Hoos Obese.
You can thank Jack Black for that. Alright.
I thank Jack Black from anything.
Right? Annie Hoos Obese is for them. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, tell us about
for those about to rock.
where your unique Bahamian accent comes from.
Oh, I worked on that. So I am Bahamian. I was just raised in the U.S. That's all. Simple as that.
Okay.
Except it's a little more complicated than that.
Is it, Tom?
Because you weren't entirely raised in the U.S., were you? If you were entirely raised in the U.S., you would not be a C.R. Walker Knight.
Correct. I graduated high school here.
Exactly.
My formative years, the ones that actually kind of dictate your style of language and almost your train of thought, as actually between the ages of, I think, maybe, would they say, 4 to 10? So those are the years in which I was raised in the U.S. So I came here as a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
I was about 14 or so. So that's a long time. mm-hmm. But yeah, so I did graduate from Sarah Walker.
So there's a... They say that the geographic areas tend to mold particular parts of personalities. People in Philly are a sort of way in general. Mm. People in Nassau are a sort of way in general. Is there a vibe in the Northwest? Where
you're have a strong feeling I know where you're going with this. This guy is hilarious. Okay,
I'm asking questions.
He's asking questions, but there's like a hidden agenda behind it. I'm letting you know right now what he wants me to tell you.
I want you to tell what you think the truth is of it, because I previously did not say that. I simply said I heard, and then your friend reacted in a particular way. But I want to know what you feel about the area. Do you think there's a particular vibe?
I think it's a nice chill vibe, to be honest with you. I think we're fun-loving, open-minded individuals from the Pacific Northwest. I think so.
Would you say
some
that
person...
about people from here?
Oh, from here?
Yeah. I'm interested to know. Is there a contrast? Do you
oh,
think we're fun-loving
oh,
and...
No, there's a cultural difference, yes, absolutely.
No.
To be fair...
You sidestepped the question. Okay? Which we don't allow here.
Okay.
So, do you
think
that people in the Bahamas are, as you described your Pacific Northwest kin, or...
Sorry,
there's
something on your nose. Want you to tap your nose?
Or...
You have
a piece of
skin. Yeah, something,
it's
on your tip of your nose.
Is it gone?
No, top again.
It's a bit.
There you go, now it's basically gone, yeah. Are people still suffering from the same thing? Because I know it started freaking out. I don't know. Okay, we'll go.
Is it gone now?
Yeah.
Okay.
No,
I have to make sure I look up for people. I'm sorry. It's like, something's there moving. I don't want a stranger to tell you it.
Okay. Matthew brought this weirdo into my life, and I like it. So the question is, are Bahamians... As you have described the Pacific Northwest folk, fun-loving and open-minded.
Yes.
Liar.
I do. No, I'm just saying, because I know where he was going with that, with the PNW people. I knew what he was going to say. He's trying to...
No. Hold on. You're continuing to sidestep here, because what I want... I didn't want to say that they were anything. I wanted to know... if you agreed with that. And you've put forward that they're fun-loving. And now we want to know, do you think that the Bahamians are fun-loving and open-minded?
Not as open-minded, no. But I think I've seen a change over the years, though, honestly. I've seen some subtle differences now. I mean, from when I first arrived to now, I've seen some changes. Is it massive? Not really, but I could at least take note of it. There is some change.
Okay, like what?
Okay, so children, well, say I'm going to compare from when I actually came into schools and to, like, let's say fun day, let's talk about, like, the way they dress. Like, when the children had the opportunity to dress the way they want to dress,
right.
It was all, like, this uniformity kind of look thing that was going on, and everyone just happened to have to look this way. So it tells me that their parents' influence and everything kind of, like, weighed heavy on it, and they refused to, like, truly be an individual, because when I came, this is the era where I came from the era with those JNCO jeans. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that. This is a wide leg pants thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're not familiar with Washington State or anything like that, it's like the grunge capital.
Right.
So I came grunge wear to fun day. So could you imagine that kind of look? and that kind of androgynous kind of look kind of thing going on, like, what? Why are you dressed like that kind of thing, where every, like, all the girls are super feminine looking and everything, and I was not, and I was like completely comfortable with that, with my flannel shirt and wide leg jeans. Yeah, that was not the thing to wear.
Mm-hmm.
But now I see children now in 2022 and 23, they're changing the way they dress. They don't all look the same anymore. And I'm kind of happy to see that. I'm like, great. I can see your personality. I can see what your,
mm-hmm.
What your aesthetic is, and that's kind of refreshing.
So I was away recently, right? And I observed this where I was. I was in Montreal, and you know, these larger cities, you'll see the groupings of people more so. Just because there's way more people, you have an opportunity to see.
You find your tribe, whatever.
Yeah.
Right. But the question occurred to me, like, how much of this is them exploring or expressing versus, okay, you've seen some glimmer of something you like, and now you sort of channeled into that through external forces, instead of just continuing to express what you are. Like, maybe you started out a little emo, but then you have an affinity for hippie, but you are emo, so you can't really transition to emo. I don't know if that's the case. I just have the question that comes up.
I think that's a little. I think that is a little rigid, because I think one of the things that defines that age, that time in life, is trying things on.
Mm-hmm. I just wonder, like,
mm-hmm.
How much of that trying on is stunted by trying something on and then getting stuck in it? Not necessarily because you really want to, but because this is, above all else, the period where you transition from relationship with parents to relationship with peers,
yeah.
And now you have this peer pressure and you get sort of locked in,
mm-hmm.
which is, yeah, happens all over the world, but
I hear you, and I would say, and maybe Tara could weigh in on this, is that there is a, I think, a natural rate of attrition,
mm-hmm.
right? I think there's people who are going to be individuals are going to be individuals,
mm.
regardless of society, regardless of culture. There's a certain kind of person who's going to be themselves regardless.
Right.
And those people will always be themselves. And I think that the majority are just by definition comfortable being a majority, being comfortable with whatever the overwhelming aesthetic is. I'll just do that because I don't really feel strongly one way or the other.
Mm.
So since I don't feel strongly, I might as well just do whatever everyone else is doing. When you have, I mean, that's why Malcolm Gladwell calls them outliers, right?
Mm.
Because they lie outside of the norm, outside of the group.
That's the reason why I actually made the comparison to, like, when I was in school,
right.
and to the kids I see now. And now looking at it, I'm noticing a difference. There is a cultural shift, I think,
mm-hmm.
especially in the Bahamas, that the younger generation is a little bit more open than when I was in that field. I'm telling you right now.
Mm-hmm.
It was very strict. It was very limiting. And I feel as though there's been a change. So that's why I was able to say that.
Mm-hmm.
I can see that we've evolved slightly. I can see that.
You wanted to be an astronaut.
Yes, I did. I mean, I still kind of do. But I'm like, oh,
there is hope for us, Tara.
Yeah, I do realize that. I mean,
just got to live long enough now.
Right? Yeah.
Elon Musk has...
I was about to say, I was like, well, anything's possible now. This point. Yeah. No, I wanted to be an astronaut.
X. God help us all. And then you wanted to study mortuary science?
Yeah, that was my goal.
So, from the darkness of space to the darkness of the grave.
There was an in-between. There was a fighter jet pilot, so let's not forget that part.
on the way down.
On the way down, slowly descending into the grave.
Let's shoot some bogeys.
Yes.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah. So,
okay.
Yeah, I wanted to do that, but I was discouraged as a child by a parent. It's like, yeah, astronaut. I can't do the exact term because I don't know if it's going to be allowed on this thing, but anyway.
This is your world. Say whatever you want to say.
Oh, his exact words, and this is my father's, it's hilarious. He's like, you don't know if you made an ass or not? And I'm like, no, what? I always remember that line because I'm like, what? Who says that? And I'm like,
brutal.
Inside as a child, I'm like, well, that sounds stupid. And it made me feel like my dreams are dumb. So I was like, yeah, let me be more realistic about it. I'm like, well, the people are dying every day. So I'm like, hey, I could capitalize on that. Wow. And yeah, I went extremely morbid. I'm like, let's do that. And then I was presented with something. A different offer for my family, for my brother, my sister, and the company. And they're like, we'll just do photography and make some money now. I'm like, yeah, let's do that. So it's
okay,
a weird chain of events.
So you did photography for quite a while.
Yeah.
But you are, in my eyes, I mean, I know you both in capabilities and in actual function to be doing a lot in terms of film in particular. Right.
Yes.
So anywhere from writing to producing to editing,
yes,
the gamut, right?
Yeah.
But I view you primarily as an actor.
Yes.
So what gets you there? How do you jump from photography? Like, was this already innate or did you just come across it? Was it a love for a film that was already there? Like, what makes you jump out and be like, I want to get in front of this lens and do foolishness?
I was obsessed with film, period, from since I was a kid. My earliest memory is, my earliest memory is watching TV and seeing the Sesame Street. And I'm like, yeah, I like television. And I kept on watching different programs, reading a lot of books, and that's something that was always inside of me. And so doing the family photography thing, I just realized, hey, my side thing that I like to do, my little hobby, was doing plays and doing little skits and that and whatnot. And I realized, you know what? I could actually combine the two. Because I'm trying to figure out how is it separate? How is photography separate from video? Because I mean, you go from still to motion picture. So what is the difference? And so I started making that kind of connection.
Right.
Like, let me just do it.
You know, it just occurred to me. This is at the time when DSLRs start to get video mode.
Absolutely. And
right.
So
digital cinema has this just complete and utter revolution over this very short period of time.
Yeah.
How? Oh my. Yeah. Okay. So I remember. Was it a T60? No.
A T1S.
Yeah. T1. It was a T1i and it would overheat.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Our company, my family's company, solely only used Canons.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I knew about the overheating issue for all the different models.
So,
yeah.
I'm a Nikon freak, so the T90s.
So back to what you were saying,
Matthew,
you
said
something about Nikon. Yeah.
Oh, my
God. You have to understand, Nikon up their game. But at the time, in the video world, they were laughing stuff.
Of course.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't do video. My last camera was a Nikon F4S, right before Nikon released the F5, which was their first like super digital SLR. And I miss old school photography. Like I miss that, the art and the craft
there's
of
a beautiful,
it.
Yeah,
yeah,
there's a beautiful craft there.
Mm-hmm.
But you were more interested in the video. But before we get to that, tell me about Second Life. Because you were cutting movies in a VR-ish world long before last year or 2 years Meta craze kicked in and fizzled out.
Oh, you're talking about Sims.
Sims. What was it? It was Sims.
Yeah, Sims, yeah.
Oh,
it
was Second
Life.
Yeah, okay.
No, it was
all right,
Sims.
So let me get an answer. So tell me about Sims.
Okay, so I started like I said, once again, I was in still photography, and I just wanted to make films. And the truth of the matter is I actually just wanted to act in films. I just wanted to be just strictly an actress, but living in the Bahamas.
But how? I'm sorry.
Like how Jennifer got the cross.
Yeah. That's you. Matthew asked that question.
Yeah.
And then he got distracted.
Yeah.
By.
You gotta make sure you stay on those.
No, no. Only because I want to see the transition, though. I don't see it yet.
Right? I know. It's going to take a while to get there. We're going to get there eventually, though.
Okay.
I promise you. All right. I just wanted to just be an actress straight up because I'm like, you know what? I think I'm pretty good at this. And I can remember lines. And like, you know, why can't I just do this? And, you know, people always say I'm animated anyway. So I'm like, might as well put it to good use. And I realized that gigs were like very few and like long stints in between. And I didn't even know where to find the stuff, like find groups or whatnot. And that's how I got involved with track, really, actually. That was my first thing over here to get involved with when it came to acting and whatnot. But anyway, what was the question? Oh, yeah, so while doing photography, I'm like, hey, you know what? It's taken so long. I could just make a film because I have this story in my head. But I'm like, wait, I don't have any experience in shooting anything. I mean, we do a DSLR, but we're using it for still shots only because that's what the company for. And I can't take the company camera and start doing my own thing now, can I? So I'm like, I have this game on my computer right now, Sims, and I realized it had a record feature inside of it, so you could actually record play modes in it. And I'm so, listen to me, I was a Sim addict, okay? So I knew how to like get them to do anything I want at any given time without having the plumb bob being saved. If you guys don't plumb bob, sorry, it's a little green thing that sits on top of people's head, but anyway. I did that, and I was like, hey, if I add music to this, it could be a silent film. And so I started doing short Sim movies, and then putting on this page, it was called Machinima at the time. And by the way, that page has crashed, like it only lasts like a year, but anyway, because there's so much people adding films to it. So me and my brother were doing those type of Sim films, and it just kind of evolved from that to where I was like, can I just use the DSLR that we have now and start making films? Because I'm like, I already have the layout of like what I'm trying to do, and so. Kind of just kind of kept on going into further and further madness and until I actually started doing actual film with people, you know, an actual DP.
I don't think the question got answered.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, no. Well, what was the question? You said Sims? That's how I started. Sorry. That's how I started doing it.
No, my question. You answered his question.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. And your question was? Sorry to remind me.
How the heck did you become an actress?
Oh, so, yeah. So, in between doing, like, photography. Okay, so here's the thing. This was a pipe dream, this whole acting thing, because once again, I came from the family that was like, astronaut is definitely out of question. Being a mortician was kind of, I don't know, it seems crazy too to them, which I'm like, what did you expect me to do? I'm like, I don't know what else you want me to do, because that's something I kind of like, you know what I mean? And anyway, I'm like, in between doing that and realizing, hey, the reason why I can't really achieve the dreams I want to is because I didn't have funds, and my family's not super rich or anything like that, I just worked a lot. And while doing that, I'm like, if I'm already working all these hours, I might as well do something I like. Let me just spend a car about at least 2 to 3 hours out of the day, because it's between 4 hours in a day. Let me do something that I actually really like. And so I split between martial arts and the acting group, which is Track Road Theater, which is a non-profit organization that dealt with both acting and theater and all that jazz. And so I did that. And I did that along with, the Spot. And so I started doing improv training and stuff like that. So in between that long hours of working, I actually found 3 to 4 hours a day to do that hobby. Until that hobby started offering money. And I was like, oh wait, I could actually get paid for what I actually like. So I just kind of like said, let me do less of that photography thing and more of pushing this thing and getting better at that craft and doing that. And that's how I got into acting.
Yeah. So... you just kind of by the by mentioned martial arts.
Yeah, because there's two things that made me happy.
So, are you a ninja?
No, I'm not a ninja. That would be offensive attacks. I'm actually defensive. I'm not going to be attacking people. I do self-defense. So, there's a difference. So, no, I'm not a ninja. But yeah, I had to even choose between that. I had to choose acting or martial arts, and I ended up choosing acting over doing that more than that. Because if you continue doing that, by the way, I kept on getting, either I was getting really good or really bad, but I was getting a lot of injuries to my face and to my body. And I realized, hey, that's gonna mess up my continuity for one project I was working on. I was like, I got busted in my face. I'm like, this is not gonna work. And so I'm like, what do we love more? I'm like, I love them both. But I'm like, I'll go to acting. And so I just went more into acting, and I was like, if I can do it privately with the martial arts, then yeah, I'll go back into it. And it still hasn't happened yet, so Yeah, my sensei, trust me, he's very disappointed in me at this point. He's like, you're never coming back, are you? I'm like,
We apologize.
Never say never, okay?
Mm-hmm. All right. So acting grew out of whatever activities were already on your plate.
Yeah, it was an escape.
Mm-hmm. 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 How'd you get good at it?
I actually teamed myself with people who I thought were better than me. So that's why I got good at it. Once again, I told you, I did not come from a wealthy family, so therefore, I had to find cheaper routes, the cheaper go-arounds. I was like, I can't afford schooling for this, so I have to go to these programs that they have going on that are available, which was Track Road Theater, which was a nonprofit organization that dealt with theater. And all I had to give in return was my time to give back to other people. So if they're teaching me, then I have to return it. And I'm a big fan of that, like, pay it forward. So I'm like, absolutely, you taught me so much, let me pick up what you learned, and I'll regurgitate it to other people in a way that I can understand it.
Mm-hmm. So this is where I always have to throw down my trusty soapbox and jump up, because what you're essentially telling me is that you cared about the craft, right? And I would often ask aspiring actors, so how many hours out of the week have you dedicated to your craft this week or the last week? And I would get mumbles or confused looks or combination thereof. And I don't understand. I understand the pull, because most of the actors, and I understand this is a little controversial, but in this particular case, I'm here to speak the truth to you, people out there. If you want to be a minor celebrity and have people clap because you did something on stage, I'm not against that. But please don't call yourself an actor, because there's a serious craft behind that. And one of the reasons I appreciate people like Tara is that they respect that. And so they actually work at it. So I'm not sure what my point was, besides calling those people out, perhaps inspiring them to do better. And to publicly thank you for being one of the people who actually care about working on what it is that you do. I think that anyone who works at their craft appreciates that.
Well, you can thank my grandmother for that,
okay.
To be honest with you, because it comes down to my core training, which is, if you're going to do anything, you might as well be the best at it, okay? If you're going to dedicate this time to it, let's say, like you said, the hours that you put into it, if you're going to spend 4 hours doing this, and mind you, this is like 4 hours of free time from work. This is only 4 hours I had in a day to do it, and if this is what you're going to do, you better put everything you have into it each time you go at it, because it doesn't make any sense going at it half-assed, because what's the point? Because you're going to be just a whole failure at that point. So,
Quincy, you I'm not sure what to call his face here, but
I don't know. I don't know. But yeah, good thank her for that. That's the reason why.
As you stared at my little rant.
I was wondering, I don't think you went far enough.
There are many shows yet to come.
Yeah. And so I will wait for those shows. But one of the things that a couple of months ago, I had a conversation with my daughter about how I play guitar. I started playing guitar when I was 25. Before that, I had taken lessons from Liz Thornton with my brother Miles when we were kids for a couple of months. And that was, I'm talking about 11, 12, something like that. Mm. Maybe not even that old. And that was my experience with the guitar. Then I decided through a series of, not unfortunate, but very strange events. I ended up as a classical guitar major at Oral Roberts University when I was 25, having never played classical guitar before, and having never played any guitar before except for that year, or less than a year, when I was 11. And my audition for the guitar program at ORU consisted of my teacher, Joseph Glaude, saying, "Mr. Parker, you can go ahead and play some scales to warm up." I'm like, "Okay, no problem. I don't know how to do that." He's like, "All right, let's play some arpeggios for us then." I'm sorry, what's an arpeggio, please? So he kind of looked down at my papers, which he had, and he looked back at me and said, Quincy Parker? Yes, sir. It says here you want to major in classical guitar. Yes, sir. Quincy, do you play classical guitar? No, sir. Quincy, do you play any guitar at all? No, sir. And you want to major in classical guitar? Yes, sir. So he leans back. 30 seconds later, he's still kind of scratching his head, looking at me. And then after about a minute, he says, "Okay." And so that is how I got in to the guitar program at Oral Roberts University. And within 6 months of starting, I was playing professionally as his sideman at his jazz guitar gigs. It turned out that I was talented, which I didn't
know. Did you know that before you went in there?
No, okay. I had no clue.
You just know you just wanted to do it.
That's what I wanted to do.
Okay.
But what was more important, and this is the point that's germane to the point Matthew makes, is that I played guitar 8 hours a day from the minute I started until the end of my second year as a guitar. Well, there's some changes that happened in my first year, but and because of that, I improved from not playing at all to playing professionally within 6 months, and going on to when I switched my major from classical guitar to composition, which is what my degree ultimately is, I kept guitar as my primary instrument. And every year I played a guitar jury, and my juries were all aced because my desire for guitar godhood meant that I spent the time in the practice room or keeping my roommate up.
Yeah.
3 o'clock in the morning, whatever, right? So I believe that you spend the time, you put in the work, you bust your butt to get better at your craft, if that's what you really want to do.
Exactly. I'm trying my hardest not to use the word passion because I think that's been overused and struck out. And to me, it doesn't have the same thing. It doesn't resonate properly with me to use that word. But that's something that you felt was important to you. It was like instinctual that, listen, guitar is your thing. That is what you're going to do. And that's something you do for free. You don't have to be paid for it. That's just something you're going to do regardless of it. Mm-hmm. And that's how I felt with acting.
Yeah.
I love it so much and I respect it so much that I want to know all the little idiosyncrasies, a part of it, anything. Mm-hmm. I just want to know more about it.
I've been won over by this term calling instead of passion recently.
Yeah.
Because a calling intrinsically acknowledges that there will probably be pain.
Yeah.
This is not going to be just fun all the time for you. You're going to go through it.
Yeah.
My fingers, if I tell you all about my fingers. So my daughter, the end of the story is that my daughter Maya wanted to, at one point, learn to play guitar.
Uh-huh.
And I told her directly and bluntly said, I will teach you, but it's going to hurt, number one. And number two, it's not going to be fun. Because if you want to learn guitar from me, I'm going to actually teach you how to play. If what you want to do is play around on the guitar, then I encourage you to do that. There are 5 guitars in the house. Have a good time. But don't come to me and say you want lessons unless you really want lessons. Because I'm going to give you lessons, mm-hmm. which means homework, which means practice time, which means you have to take it seriously. And of course, at 6 years old, 7 years old, 10 years old, no, right? No. But now, when she was 17, 18, she was passionate enough about it and convinced enough about this being her path in life that she came to me and said, okay, I'm ready now. And now she's studying music production and songwriting and performance at Berklee College of Music. And I'm like, what the hell? When did that happen? Right? But it's like, if you commit yourself to it, mm-hmm. it will reward you.
Absolutely.
You know, it's one of those things where people sometimes don't understand. And before we started the episode, we were talking about the culture here not understanding the value that the marketplace puts on the performing and creative arts. Mm-hmm. There was 1 year of his career where Pavarotti made $91 million. In a 1 year period from his royalties, from his performances, from his whatever else, is right? Mm-hmm. And it's like, so that's one end of the spectrum, $91 million in 1 year, right? But at the other end of the spectrum is if you are a first chair for any of the orchestral instruments, you could start at a salary of $60,000 to $70,000 a year. We don't think of musical instruments equating to a salary of $60,000 to $70,000 a year.
Which is so sad.
Right? And the reality is, not only is that out there, that's commonplace. That's par for the course. That's not even the London Philharmonic or the New York Philharmonic or the Berlin. Oh, the Berlin Philharmonic. You know what I'm saying? These are mid-tier, mid-city orchestras where people are making a living playing their instruments. And unless we as a culture realize that the marketplace puts value on these things, we're going to continue to tell our children to go across the bridge and get a job at Atlantis so they can buy a Honda and some rims. Or they can go get a job at Bahama so they could focus on
putting Paso and hubcaps now. I'm sorry, don't do that.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Matthew. Push
at
back.
At the risk of contradicting myself, right? Mm-hmm. I want to give a little bit put a pushback to the market. Not to the concept, but just with the caveat that the market here is very, very small. And so
we don't live here.
These things, right? But let's not pretend like it's going to happen necessarily here. Maybe one or two people, but we have to be comfortable with the fact that that will probably mean that person not being here.
Yes.
Yeah.
And to me, that is fine. Because we don't live in the Bahamas. We live in the world. We're from the Bahamas.
I was going to say, we're all Earthlings. You're from the world.
Especially as small as the world is now. People forget sometimes, I think, that the Bahamas has one of the most powerful passports in the universe.
Yeah.
Right? You have visa-free access to more than 120 countries around the world with your Bahamian passport.
Yes.
That means you can pick up and plop down in any one of those countries for however long, maybe 4, 5, 6 months.
Yeah.
Go experience the world. Mm-hmm. Right? Maybe even get plugged into a place and then apply for a visa and say, can I stay? And they're going to be like, well, you're awesome. Sure, of course you can stay. In fact, we'll pay you to stay. Bahamians have to appreciate the amazing, the amount of talent that is just, the old song Watermelon is spoiling on the vine, right? The amount of talent that's just floating around, not being used, because we don't see that as valuable. So we'll end the show here.
Yes.
All right, folks. So so what we're going to do is I think we're going to call it for the GTR broadcast right here. And then we'll finish the conversation. And you know, you can just download the podcast from the Guardian Talk Radio website to hear the rest of the conversation. Miss Tara Woodside, superstar actor, thank you for your brilliance and your intelligence and your excitement and enthusiasm. We never did get to talk about that tattoo.
No, that's because we have to go. So that's.
Yeah. I kind of want to.
It's a fast one. If you want to know, I mean, this one right here.
Mm-hmm.
Inshallah.
Ah. Hmm. Inshallah, as God wills it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite phrases.
There you go.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you, and God bless, and we'll see you next week or next time on the Sunday Scotch Society.